This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by Huggies Little Movers. Huggies knows that babies come in all shapes and sizes, and your tushies do too. No matter what kind of butt you've got, you'll feel comfy while your baby's mushy little tushy wiggles and jiggles all around. Get your baby butt in the best-fitting diaper. Huggies Little Movers. We got you, baby.
Hi, everyone. This is Margaret Brennan, moderator of Face the Nation. We sat down with four freshman Congress members, two Democrats and two Republicans, to talk about compromise and bipartisanship in a divided Washington, D.C. We asked them about what has surprised them the most in their first month in Washington, how to legislate on crime and immigration, and what to do about the looming debt ceiling deadline. Here's the full conversation. Joining us now for a look at the new Congress, a group of freshman House members. Congressman Robert Garcia is the president of the Democratic freshman class. He's from the state of California. Gentleman next to him is New York Republican Congressman Mike Lawler. Congresswoman Summer Lee is a Democrat, and she is from the state of Pennsylvania. And Congressman Zach Nunn is a Republican from Iowa. And it's good to have you all at the same table.
Thank you.
And I wonder... Is this the first time that you've had a bipartisan conversation since you came to Washington?
No. We had orientation, which was bipartisan.
Yeah. We talked a little bit at some of the events. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I want to jump into a number of the big questions, but I wonder just if we could go around the table, what has surprised you in this first month on the job?
I mean, first, I think what's been a great surprise is how united Democrats are. I think we're united to win back the majority in 2 years. We've been pushing back on what we view as Republican extremism. We've seen it on the floor time and time again. And I've also been really, really impressed with just how Democrats really represent what America is all about today, standing up for working people and really trying to uplift the middle class. And so that's something that I'm really proud of. And I think that freshman Democrats are united first and foremost to win back the majority.
Is being in the majority everything you hoped for?
Well, coming from the permanent minority of the state legislature in New York, it's great. You know, obviously, we had an interesting first few days with the speaker vote. But the reality is we have gotten unified and we are advancing forward with our Republican agenda. And the bottom line here is this. The American people wanted a check and balance on the Biden administration. They did not want one party rule. And coming from a state like New York, where I represent a district that Joe Biden won by 10 points and there's 70,000 more Democrats than Republicans, my objective is to find solutions. And I had among the most bipartisan voting records in Albany. And I will have the same down here because regardless of party, we have to do the work of the American people. And that's what I've been focused on since coming here over the last month.
Congresswoman, what surprised you?
I find little surprising with government. You know, I also came from what we thought was going to be a permanent minority in Pennsylvania. So I've dealt with having limited say. I've dealt with kind of the chaos that we have when you're not in control. So dealing with that and going through that, right, I've had experience doing that. So what we kind of recognize is that our goal here is to continue to put forth an agenda for working people, an agenda for working families, making sure that we're pushing that. There are going to be opportunities to do that. But also there are going to be many barriers. So I don't find the barrier surprising, but I think that, like many others, you know, the first week of Congress was pretty surprising. And, you know, just taking that long to get sworn in, right, was not something that I don't think any American, you know, thought was in the cards for us.
You didn't think you'd be sworn in the middle of the night?
No, on Saturday. No, that was not what we expected.
It was historic.
Yeah. Many ways.
That's all right. Yeah.
Not in a good way, though.
Congressman Nunn.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm coming from a military background. I'm thrilled with freshman class, both Republicans and Democrats. And what a number of us did is we took time to really sit down over coffee with each other. I've been working with my Democratic colleagues. I'm from a Midwestern state. We're not going to get things through unless we sit down and work with other folks who are geographically aligned with us. I'm not as interested in the R or the D after the name, so long as we're finding pragmatic solutions. You know, as a, you know, military officer, one of the things that we worked on very clearly was we had one common goal with a very diverse team. Mm-hmm. And you can achieve objectives by setting out clear standards. I think, you know, around this table even, we'll probably agree on the majority of things. Maybe how we get there is different, but we all have an intent that we came here to serve. We didn't spend 18 plus months on a campaign trail to come here and not get things accomplished. Republicans, Democrats have the opportunity to really move forward on things that are important for communities like mine in rural Iowa, as well as places as diverse as New York, California, and Pennsylvania, so long as we are focused on having an open dialogue. We saw that this week with the president and the Speaker of the House. I hope that continues in our freshman class.
What concerns you most about the state of our politics in our country?
Yeah, so I'm privileged to get to sit on financial services and ag. And across the board, I think we have a common threat. First amongst those is one of our near peer states. That's the state of China. The role here is that this becomes a direct threat not only to our national security, mm-hmm. but it's what's happening to folks and farms in my own district, yours as well. We have an opportunity here to really stand up with a clear policy measure that China can be an ally to the United States and offer them an on-ramp to be successful, or we can start finding ways to make sure that we hold them accountable now so we're not playing catch-up like Ukraine a year later.
Are you talking about ownership of farmland?
Absolutely. Ownership of farmland, ownership of intellectual property, the theft of what's coming out of the United States, as well as what China is doing behind the scenes to really threaten even our local populations. The extreme spread of fentanyl, it's pouring across our borders. It's a direct threat to my community and ours across the area. And then also a China that remains unchecked, one that is looking at investing on U.S. dollars that are taking money out of our economy and then putting it back into growing not only the People's Liberation Army, but really a counterweight to where the United States economy can be.
Congressman, you talked about Republican extremism. Does that sound like extremism to you?
Listen, I think that there's going to be some things we all agree on. But at the end of the day, you got to look at the agenda and what Republicans and Speaker McCarthy have put forward in just for a couple of weeks of the Congress. Mm-hmm. Congressman Lee and I both serve on the Oversight Committee. Their very first hearing is about attacking essentially the pandemic response. I mean, we know that we had a pandemic that killed over a million Americans in my town alone where I was mayor. 1,300 people died, and they're attacking vaccines. They're attacking the pandemic response. They're attacking basic tools like allowing healthcare workers to be masked or be vaccinated. That is extreme. That is not coming together and supporting the country. And so when you start attacking the pandemic, when you start attacking the women's ability to make decisions about our own body as it relates to abortion care and access, when you're expanding the opportunity for gas and drilling on federal lands, that's been the initial opening salvo of the Republican Party in the Congress. And so I think as freshmen, we're trying to push back on that. And so I appreciate the kind of spirit of working together. There's a lot other things that we should be working on, and in my opinion, than attacking the country, attacking healthcare workers, and attacking women.
So what is it that's the biggest issue in the country right now? What is it that has you most concerned?
Well, for me, there's a couple of things. I think number one, obviously, we all want to make sure that the economy continues to improve. I think the president's done a great job of bringing us back out of a real difficult recovery period because of the pandemic. We're all focused on that. But there's other big issues like immigration. As an immigrant myself, there are 11 million people in this country that deserve a pathway to citizenship or deserve some type of opportunity to gain citizenship. Mm-hmm. That's an area where I would hope that Republicans can come to the table to work on. We have an ability to also work to uplift the working people in this country, ensure that we're not just providing tax cuts to billionaires and millionaires, but actually providing tax relief to small working families. So I'm hopeful that Republicans will get on board with some of those agenda items.
Mm-hmm. You sound like you're on the campaign trail. You were put on the oversight committee. You were as well, by Leader Jeffords. Why do you think he selected the two of you for that particular committee, which seems like it is a place where we're going to see a lot of political fights rather than legislation?
Well, I mean, it's a committee that is, you know, about oversight, right? It's one of the least legislative committees, right? Right. It's not there for us to see bills advance. It's there for us to do accountability. It's right. There for us to oversee the government, to make sure that it's accountable to American people. So I think that Leader Jeffries put folks like me and Robert Garcia on this committee because we need people who are going to continue to redirect the conversation mm-hmm. back to what American people actually sent us here to accomplish, making sure that we are redirecting us and making sure that we are being very careful with taxpayer dollars with the investigations that we do, right? Are we going to spend time investigating a Biden's laptop, or are we going to spend time making sure that we're holding corporations mm-hmm. accountable in the middle of a pandemic, right, where we see unprecedented price gouging and we're seeing folks who are hit at every level from every angle, right, who are trying to make way and trying to make by. So I think that we're there because we need fighters. We need people who are going to speak truth to power, and we need people who are going to not just go with the flow, right, just not going to let our country be led down a pathway of ridiculousness, to be quite frank, mm-hmm. but instead redirecting to make sure that we are thinking about American people every single day and their best interests.
So you just had the very first hearing on that committee, and it was about COVID, but yep. pandemic, federal funding, and wasteful yep. spending. Do you think that was a waste of time?
I think that it was a disingenuous attack. We're in the midst of a pandemic where in my state, in my home state, within months, we had almost a million folks who found themselves unemployed, right? Who were desperate. They were not, they couldn't figure right. out where they were going to eat. And we knew that we needed to respond immediately, right? And this is a distraction from the people who were suffering, the people who had very real needs that we met, that we were able to meet because of federal funding, because of federal programs, and to attack them when I think about the ways in which the pandemic disproportionately impacted communities like mine, yeah. Black and brown communities, disabled communities. This is an ongoing pandemic, and it seems like we're more willing to look backwards at how we could have slowed down aid instead of figuring out how we're going to actually get everybody through the pandemic and not just able-bodied folks.
Can I just highlight on this? You know, I appreciate what my colleagues are saying. And Mike, I'm going to turn over to you here. Look, I was a National Guardsman on the front line providing COVID response to folks. And our state, Iowa, was one of the first states to open back up. It was to flatten the curve, not to have a 3-year-plus lockdown on what was happening here. Mm-hmm. The president's admitted himself. He's ending it, but he's still rolling it till May. We have the opportunity to open up states, businesses, families, communities, so people didn't have to be put out of work for a year. We didn't have kids who are now years and years behind where they should be in their learning process when schools, again, like the Midwest, opened back up and got children back to the in-person learning that was so important mm-hmm. for them.
But the focus of the committee on paper is supposed to be looking at waste in federal spending, not right. relitigating the pandemic. I mean, it just sounds mm-hmm. like, I think, for a lot of people at home, that this is all going to be a big political brawl for the next 2 years. No, is that what that looks like?
I'm serving on financial services and foreign affairs, and those are two substantive committees that are going to deal with a lot of important issues over the next 2 years. But just on the issue of the pandemic, coming from New York, you know, former Governor Cuomo made a policy directive that really put seniors in harm's way. And that is something that should be investigated. The New York State Comptroller has acknowledged that there is billions of dollars of waste in unemployment insurance fraud as part of the COVID pandemic. So to just dismiss this and say, oh, there should be no investigation, I think is really disingenuous when you look at the amount of money that has been spent over the last 2 years in response to COVID. Yes, there was legitimate things that we needed to help the American people through, but there's also serious concerns about how that money was spent. For me, this is, at the end of the day, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, all of us want a few basic things in life, right? We want a good-paying job to provide for our families. We want a quality education for our children. We want access to housing and health care. And we want to live in safe neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. For me, that's why I ran for office. That's why I'm down here. And I think there's a lot of work that we can do together to address these challenges.
Like
yes,
what?
There's going to be fights. There's going to be disagreement on issues. Frankly, over the last 2 years, the Democratic Congress provided very little to no oversight over the Biden administration. So this is about ensuring accountability. The American people wanted to have a check and balance, and that is what the House Republican majority will be.
Okay. Let me ask you, Monday is going to be the second anniversary of the attack on the United States Capitol. In the time since then, there have been at least 7,000 potential threats against lawmakers. I wonder, as you all made the decision to run for office and to come here, how do you think about your own safety and that of your family? Congresswoman?
I'm a progressive Black woman who, when we see who the trends of who are typically most at risk, the people who get the most threats, the most vitriol, the most hatred, I think about Congresswoman Omar. I think about Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez. I think about former Speaker Nancy Pelosi. I know, and it's unfortunate, but we know when we take this on that we are putting ourselves at risk. We know that we're putting our families at risk. I know that people know where we live. I know that when we say things, when we talk about issues that make people uncomfortable, for me, specifically, when I talk about racial justice, when we talk about poverty, when we talk about working workers' rights, right? Every time we talk about that, we see an increase in hate speech. We see an increase of people who are targeting us. And we know that we have to work through that because it's necessary, because our voices are needed here, because we know that people are attempting to scare us out of these roles. But we have to take precautions. And that's why I'm happy that we have added security, right? That we're able to at least make our houses more secure, right? That's it's a very small thing to do, but even just having alarms and making sure that we're walking in crowds with people, we take every precaution, but.
But you're concerned.
Absolutely.
When you see the video of the former speaker's husband being attacked, it's horrifying. And when you think about your own family, and the fact that they are subjected to this vitriol, to this hatred, I think it is deeply concerning. And so I think all of us as elected officials have an obligation when debating these issues, when talking about them, to really do so in a civilized manner, because it provokes people on all sides. You know, I could look at my Twitter feed today and it's just it's a lot of nonsense that you see. But nobody should be subjected to violence, to hatred, to bigotry, to racism of any kind. And the fact that the former speaker's husband, who you would have thought they would have had the most security out of anybody, could be subjected to that type of attack, it has no place in our country.
But to get back to your question, I mean, you I think everyone here is right. And we all renounce hatred and we renounce violence. But we also have to go back to what you mentioned about the Capitol attack as well. And we have still in this Congress members, particularly on the other side, that are unwilling to renounce the insurrection, that are unwilling to renounce members within the Republican Party that are standing up and they're saying very violent things.
Who are you thinking of?
Well, I mean, I'll take someone like Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example. I think the way that, in my opinion and many others, the way that she incited violence, the way that she continues to defend those that attacked our government, that attacked our Capitol, the way that she has continues to not support what the Capitol Police tried to do that day, and the way that she has treated other members of not just her caucus, but of course of the Democratic caucus, I think is unacceptable. I think it's shameful. I think that if you cannot stand up and say that what happened on January 6th was treason and was a tyranny against her own government and her own people, I don't think you should be in Congress. And she shouldn't be in Congress.
So, Margaret, fair enough. I think we all at this table can agree that what happened on January 6th, truly a tragic day in history. We are also, I would offer, looking at this very much in an insular D.C. bubble. Look, I put my hand on the Bible and I've flown operations with Russians being firing missiles at us. We all put our name out there because we want to serve our country. The true challenge that I see is the violence that has spiked over the last 2 years across the country. And so in my home district, we had a shooting at a kid's school that killed two children. Mm-hmm. We had a teacher try to help rescue them. Look, these are situations we need to get to the root cause of with respect, not just talk about January 6th and how threatened we feel, but really how under siege our communities are.
All about crime, actually, in a few minutes. But to answer the question, you as a lawmaker, right, putting yourself and your family at risk in this environment, how did you come to peace with that? I mean, it's kind of incredible that you have to have this conversation right now. More than 7,000 threats against lawmakers. That doesn't come from nowhere.
Last year, we had the highest number of deaths of law enforcement. I think there are a lot of brave men and women across the country who constantly are putting themselves on the front line. So we are all recognize the challenge, but I think it pales in comparison to what some of the brave heroes do every day.
But you, we will come to crime, but on that question of you
yeah.
and your family.
So, yeah, we've got four little kiddos.
In this
we've got
environment
two foster kids.
That the security measures to date, the funding that was just, for example, appropriated in the last Congress to help secure your families and put in the alarm systems and do things like that. You had to weigh that when you ran for office. Why was that worth that?
I think there are a lot of things that anybody who's going to step into the public arena puts themselves out there. Both your public safety, your family's integrity, that of your community. And so we weigh all of those things going forward. It's not an easy choice. But at the end of the day, we do it because we are trying to help a better community. Whether you're serving on the front line in your community or in Congress, mm-hmm. you've taken the sacrifice because you truly hope you can make a difference.
But to be clear, yeah. it's unacceptable. We shouldn't be here where we are now. We shouldn't be in this environment. We're seeing our country. We're seeing a widening chasm, right? A widening mm-hmm. chasm in this country. Disconnect and division. And when we think about the disinformation campaigns, when we think about the vitriolic statements that we hear from leaders of this country, leaders of this world, and when we think about the ways in which people are targeted because of them, mm-hmm. we know that there is language that incites violence. And when we, as members of Congress, when we as member public servants, can't denounce it every single time, we put another one of our colleagues at risk. Mm-hmm. So this isn't something that we should just accept. It's something that we should fix.
Okay. I'm going to take a quick break. But this is why I like having bipartisan conversations, because we're trying to have positive conversations that are productive. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll have another conversation on the other side of it with these new members.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
And we're back now with our panel of new House members. So I want to talk about some of the things you all think you can get done here in Washington. Congressman Lawler, the former Speaker Nancy Pelosi recently told the New York Times that Democrats could have held on to the House if New York politicians had realized earlier on that crime was such a key motivating issue. In the last Congress, they greenlit about $4 billion in grants for local law enforcement. Do you think that money now needs to be accompanied by some kind of reform, something more on crime?
Well, I've said repeatedly, in New York State specifically, that cashless bail was one of the most dangerous policies enacted, because New York State is the only state in the country that does not have a dangerousness standard. So judges don't have discretion when it comes to holding somebody who may be a harm to society. And over 40% of those released on non-monetary bail for felony offenses have been rearrested since cashless bail took effect. So that law needs to be repealed. And much like New Jersey did, where they put cashless bail in effect, but they allowed judges to have discretion, that's what New York needs to do.
But here in Washington.
Here in Washington, there's a lot of bipartisan support, I think, for especially making sure that law enforcement has the resources they need and the training that they need to do their jobs effectively. I think, obviously, the situation in Memphis with Tyre Nichols is a horrifying example. When an individual is murdered and never should have happened. Mm-hmm. And those officers were rightly terminated and are being held accountable. They've been charged with his murder. We will see, hopefully, swift justice there. But I think there's a lot of area where we can work together to address the rise in crime and why we are seeing such a rise across the country.
Like what? How would you address that? Or what do you see the Republican platform on this issue being, if it's not police reform?
Well, listen, Tim Scott has put forth a bill that the Democrats rejected last Congress. I think that's something that we should certainly reevaluate. But I think, again, you have to look at What are some of the root causes of why, you know, we're seeing such an increase in crime, gang activity? Obviously, you see the scourge of fentanyl pouring into our communities, drugs being dealt that are having a devastating impact. So I think there is a lot of area where we can work together to address these challenges. We need to make sure that people have housing, economic opportunity, education. Those all play into, obviously, when you see an increase in crime. Those are issues that impact that. And so I think we need to figure out ways to work together in a bipartisan way to address these challenges.
What about you, Congressman? This is your party in the majority. $4 billion in grants just went to local law enforcement. Does Congress need to do anything more to address crime?
No, I think we have a long way to go here, right? When I was chair of judiciary at the state level, Iowa moved very aggressively after the George Floyd homicide. We immediately said that we were going to allow our attorney general to investigate crimes directly so that we weren't waiting on county attorneys. We made sure that bad law enforcement officers couldn't be cycled through without some kind of a background check on them that were harming the good officers. We made sure that we made a direct investment in mental health across the state and made sure that our regional, both our urban, but also our rural communities had access to that. And ultimately, we also worked with our law enforcement to make sure that law enforcement had a better relationship with the community rather than one of conflict that exploded after the defund the police movement. I think that we've seen some really good success here. There's some tangible successes we've seen at state levels. Let's bring those up to the federal level and make sure they can work the same way.
So you do want to see more legislation on?
Yeah, I think there's absolutely more that needs to be done on this. What doesn't need to be done are what I will call these fig leaf grants, the idea that we can just hire more minority officers in rural Iowa. That is a very challenging thing to do. We should be identifying, and we saw tragically, even in Memphis, that that alone is not a silver bullet solution. We've really got to get to the effort of, you know, good policing, but also recognizing when there is good law enforcement, we hold that up as a partner in a community. That's where this money could be going, and it needs to be accountable. I think far too much of this has gone to, you know, some major metropolitan areas, which have seen actually crime spike in those neighborhoods.
Congresswoman, you said it would be good to revive the George Floyd Policing Act, but we're so far past that right now, we really need to kind of escalate the conversation faster. What do you mean? What are you calling for?
So let me be really clear. There is a proliferation of disinformation and bias in conversations about crime and conversations about policing. And to be very clear, police violence is crime. We cannot say that we care about crime, but then do nothing, choose to do nothing over and over and over when the crime is committed by a police officer. There are statistics that show that less than 2% of police officers who are engaged in a misconduct are ever indicted at all. And while we can all celebrate that five black police officers, right, and it let it not escape us that it was only when they were black that there was swift action, and there was a sixth who was not black, and there was not swift action, that we can say that Tyree should be alive. So should Tatiana Jefferson. So should Antoine Rose II from my district. So should Mike Brown. So should Philando Castile. They should all be alive. So when we're talking about crime and we're talking about how we're going to solve it, when I say that we need to change the conversation, we need to acknowledge that public safety does not begin with policing. Public safety begins with investments. It begins with addressing our own implicit and explicit biases in policymaking and education and appropriations. How are we ensuring that communities that are starved of resources are getting an equitable share of resources, that we are investing in schools, that we're investing in jobs that pay a living wage, that we're investing in wraparound services, healthcare, environmental justice, after-school programs, violence interrupters. Until we're willing to do all of those, then we're not having a serious conversation about crime. Instead, what we're doing is we're whistling. It's the dog whistle. And I want us to move beyond the dog whistle, because everybody says that we care about public safety. Mm-hmm. We have empirical data that tells us what we can do about public safety, about crime. We know that there's a correlation between poverty and crime, not race, not geography, not type of community you live in. Poverty and crime, but we're not addressing poverty.
So when the president talks about reviving George Floyd Policing Act, you're saying not as it's currently written. You want more measures.
Absolutely. I want us to be intentional at every step about addressing racial bias, about addressing poverty, about addressing crime, and about addressing police violence.
But you would vote for it potentially.
Potentially.
But
I want to make sure that what we're voting for is actually going to take intentional steps to move us forward, not just performative steps to say that we've done reform.
So you hear all this. Does police reform is dead on arrival in Congress?
Well, it shouldn't be. I take myself. I was mayor of a city of 500,000 people before I got to Congress. At 800 members of our police department. And one thing you know, and it's true, I hope that we can all agree on, is that police reform, criminal justice reform is still necessary in this country. And we see over and over again that we have an issue with police, with systemic racism that still exists in institutions. And that includes our policing system, that includes our educational system, that includes healthcare. And so I think Representative Lee is absolutely right. Listen, I would vote for the George Floyd Policing Act if it was on the floor tomorrow, but more needs to be done. Additional
steps
need to be
taken. It won't be put on the floor tomorrow under Republican leadership,
absolutely.
To be clear.
And that's why I want to be clear also with when our colleagues bring up that more should be done around this issue. Well, there is a bill, and that could be reintroduced, and they could vote for. In addition to that, I think it's important that we focus on facts. Mm-hmm. The truth is that you look at a place like California or most of the country, we are actually safer today than we were 15, 20, or 30 years ago. Statistically. And so there's a lot of concerns around crime, and there should be. We all want to be safe. But I also think we also got to look at the data and actually look at the facts. The truth is that every single election cycle, it just seems that there's a lot of focus on crime and inner cities. And the truth is that we are safer than we were 20 or 30 years
ago. But there was
in
a spike in violent crime.
In New York State in particular, the reason there was a focus on crime by voters is because they didn't feel safe. You had people being pushed in front of oncoming subway cars. You had people being stabbed in the street. By the way, the vast majority of victims of crime are black and brown people. So to act as though there's not a crime issue, I think is dismissing the fact that it is serious and people do not feel safe. And so, yes, we need to address the root causes of why someone may turn towards crime or why they may find themselves as part of a gang. But we also need to hold people accountable with the decisions that they make. And I think part of the problem here is that oftentimes it is very easy to go say law enforcement bad, but the vast majority of people who are in law enforcement are good people. They want to come home to their families safely. They don't want to use their guns. They don't want to kill people. They're not looking to bring harm to anybody in the community. I come from a community that has strong law enforcement presence. 50% of households in my district have a cop, a firefighter, a first responder, or a veteran in them. They're good people, and they want to do right by our communities.
The vast majority of people in poor and working class neighborhoods are good people.
They are.
And they are victims of crime that we don't say anything about. For instance,
they want police presence. Exactly.
For instance, there is no police presence when they're a victim of wage theft. We're not seeing anybody fear-mongering.
I passed legislation.
And I would like to see it happening here. Because what we don't see when we're talking about crime, we're really talking about white-collar crime. We're really talking about ways in which we're going to hold corporate criminals accountable. We're really taking any strides in any level of government to do anything about that. But we continue to talk about the crimes of desperation, and particularly the crimes in marginalized communities.
So I don't hear any agreement here. I want to ask you about some other issues. You raised, for example, immigration and border security earlier in the conversation. Obviously, there's so many different pieces to this puzzle. It has been years, and there has been a failure to legislate on this. What's going to be different in a split Congress now? Do you see hope for this?
I do. I really do. And I think I've been down to the border. I've seen firsthand people come across looking for a better opportunity. I met with an individual who had the opportunity to come here. He'd been waiting for 6 years and finally decided, well, I'm going to try this. And now he's free somewhere in America. The challenge right now is until we secure the border, we have a really porous situation where the folks who are coming here illegally are jumping ahead of the folks who are coming here legally. The folks who have set up shop in America and want to be good citizens are finding themselves outfoxed by people who are being encouraged to come here illegally. And it's not like everybody has the chance. It's those who can get here. Look, I served multiple tours in Afghanistan. We brought my Afghan interpreter to the United States after 9 combat tours. He became a U.S. citizen. I flew out the largest group of, all-volunteer folks with Task Force Argo to come to the United States, 3,000 of them, Americans and our allies. We still have folks who are legally allowed to come to the United States that can't leave the country under this administration who have been forgotten about, and they served 20 years, and we paid to help their education and their families. But instead, we're allowing a situation where we're allowing some of the largest amount of illegal immigrants to come into this country and not supporting them. We're doing them a disservice when they come here by turning them loose with no ability to be able to support them or their families.
I also don't hear any proposal that either of you will ever agree on. Two of you.
Let's secure the border and let's have a legal pathway.
I think
we would all hopefully agree on that.
I think most Republicans in this Congress have been disingenuous on immigration. I'm an immigrant. I came to the U.S. when I was a young kid. I had the privilege and honor of becoming an American in my early 20s. I am grateful to this country. I love this country. Immigrants love this country. They just want an opportunity to be here, a pathway to citizenship.
But you're talking about dreamers.
Worker program.
You're talking about border security.
Right.
I mean, there are different
you can do
aspects
both.
Of this.
What part
of this can get through in this Congress? Which piece?
I would hope that both
could be.
I agree with you on that.
The thing is that, unfortunately, there's this myth that Democrats somehow aren't concerned about a secure border, that we don't want an orderly process. But we also want to ensure that we want secure, everybody wants a secure border, all of our borders, by the way, not just the southern border. We want to have a secure country. But we also want to ensure that we're talking about the humanity of people. These are people that are coming to this country that are desperate, that are suffering. We are a country of immigrants, of people that came here for a better life, like myself, like my family, like my mom. And so this idea that we can't give these people justice, we can't support and help them, I think is anti-American. And so I hope that in this Congress, Speaker McCarthy and our Republican friends will actually come to the table with an immigration package that we can all get behind. And I am hopeful, like some of you, I have talked to some Republicans on the other side that have an interest in a broader immigration reform package. And that's something that I hope that we can all work on.
My wife is an immigrant as well. And she came to this country about a decade ago in search of economic opportunity. She comes from Eastern Europe, a former Soviet satellite state. The bottom line here is this. We embrace immigration, all right? All of us at some point, somehow, our families came here. And if you look at it, we need immigration. Immigrants enrich our communities, our culture, and our economy. But we have to have a legal process. And you can't continue to have tens of thousands of migrants pouring across the border every day and then being left to fend for themselves in communities all across our country. So you need to secure the border. We need to increase border patrol. We need to increase the number of judges and court personnel to hear asylum cases. Nobody should be waiting 2 to 3 years to hear an asylum case with the hope that they may come back for the court hearing. That's insane. So we absolutely have to secure the border. We need to deal with the fact that you have 25 million plus folks who are here undocumented. Right. And not everybody is going to be able to get a pathway to citizenship, but we're certainly not rounding up and kicking out 25 million people. Right. And so there needs to be a process to deal with that. And then we need to fix the legal immigration process so that people who want to come here can do so legally and contribute to our communities, to our culture, to our economy. And I think there can be broad bipartisan agreement on this if everybody is willing to kind of give a little. Both sides have failed on immigration for years, for years. This is not one party or the other. Both sides have failed miserably here. And we have a situation that is unsustainable. And on top of it all, you have fentanyl pouring across the southern border, killing hundreds of thousands of our citizens year after year after year.
Yeah.
That is a crisis that needs to be dealt with.
I want to move on to governance and debt. But did you have something? Because I didn't. Okay. On basic governance. Can I see a show of hands? Are you all confident that America will avoid defaulting on its debt?
Yes. Yes.
I think show of hands.
I'd like to think so.
I hope so.
You're confident we will avoid the cliff.
We absolutely will. The bottom line is this. We have incurred debt previously. We have an obligation to pay that. We will lift the debt ceiling.
Do you believe that some of your Republican colleagues who have been very in a very different place on this will come along and that the party...
Absolutely. But here's the point I would make. Over the past many decades, major spending reform has been tied to the debt ceiling. Okay, so the White House needs to recognize one thing. One-party rule in Washington is over. They need to negotiate with the Speaker in good faith to come to a long-term agreement that puts us on the path to fiscal solvency. We cannot continue to spend at the levels that we have and incur more debt at the levels that this administration and previous administrations before it have. Mm-hmm. It's unsustainable.
There needs to be
a longer-term agreement, and it requires a good-faith negotiation.
Right. I think a lot of people would agree with you on the broader premise, but on the specifics of the debt ceiling. Speaker McCarthy was just here.
Yep.
And was saying that at this moment in time for him, those two issues are going to be linked. In the event that we are at that brink, if he is convinced to put a clean bill on the floor, in other words, you might be asked to vote with Democrats to lift it. Would you do so? 15 Republicans along with the rest of the Democrats.
Look, I'm not going to get into the hypothetical. What I will say is this. The debt ceiling will be lifted. Mm-hmm. We will pay our debts that have been incurred. But we also have to get our fiscal house in order. And
you
so the White House,
financial services,
the White
correct.
House and the Speaker need to work together on this.
But you, I mean, yep. given the state you are from, you know,
yep.
I am sure that is a question that has been put to you.
It has by CEOs on down.
Exactly. And so it's not
I
a hypothetical
no,
in a
no,
far off at all.
Hypothetical in the situation that you're presenting. But my point is, if everybody's working in good faith, mm-hmm. both the president and the Speaker, and everybody's being responsible and recognizing that going forward, we cannot continue to incur this level of debt, mm-hmm. then we should be able to reach an agreement on this, no problem. And I think if people are being sincere about that, we will.
That's the question. Why are you confident?
Well, Margaret, I would be more confident if when the Democrats respectfully controlled all powers of government, they had the opportunity before passing a trillion-dollar budget and bouncing.
You
they
know
could
Mitch
have
McConnell
that.
Said in the Senate
but it was
is
absolutely
a June
capable.
Issue. This wasn't a unified Republican position.
We've had 3 weeks on the calendar, and this is already your first question, our first month in office. So clearly, everyone was thinking about this prior to June. The other aspect of this is...
This is a key issue that is also being raised.
100%, right. And it's... But this is no surprise to us. We've done this twice in the last 2 years. We've done it repeatedly throughout history without Republicans.
But I just want to understand,
so, Margaret,
you think that you're being set up with the debt ceiling?
No, I'm saying this could have been solved just a month ago if truly the Democrats wanted to do this. This is now a two-party conversation. It means the Senate's involved. Mm-hmm. It means the House is involved. And it means the president should not say...
The Senate has made clear this is a House issue.
But it's not, right? It's an American issue.
It will be,
and they
eventually.
Need to be part of this conversation
but that,
as well.
But I guess that's the question, is in this environment where it is so divided,
right.
including within your party, this is why we are talking about the potential... Yeah. Of Republicans,
all the more to be proactive.
Leadership not
broad,
being able to
there's
get
broad
more
agreement within
members.
Our party that
Please.
We need to get spending right. under control.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of us ran on right. reining in government spending. The Biden administration increased spending by over $5 trillion in 2 years.
Yeah.
So to say that there's disagreement within the party, frankly, there's not. The issue ultimately will be for the White House and frankly, for Senator Schumer, mm-hmm. who is from New York, to shirk his responsibility and say, well, let the House deal with this. No, come to the table, negotiate, mm-hmm. work together, and let's come up with a bipartisan solution to address this.
So
in the way it's
me,
always been done in the past.
So Social Security, health care, including Medicare, Medicaid, and then defense are the three biggest line items. Where do you cut? If you have to have this conversation, where do you cut?
Defense. The reality is that we can't keep asking the same people to compromise over and over and over. And not to say that we don't need a secure country, not to say that we are just going to say, well, we should not have a budget for it. But we are to acknowledge that that budget has increased every year. It is the highest in history every time. But every year we're asking American people to decide between Medicare, Social Security, Pell Grant recipients. Are we going to tell first generation college students who are attempting to break into a better life for themselves that there are no opportunities for them because we cannot fund a Pell Grant? Or are we going to go to people who are in the midst of a housing crisis and say that we can no longer fund housing grants for you from the federal government at your time of need, right? It's when we talk about these conversations, we have to humanize them. We have to be very clear what we are proposing to cut, who are going to be impacted by it, and then think through better ways than to just continue to hold American people hostage, to hold our budget hostage, and quite frankly, right, to continue to go back to the same people, particularly the most vulnerable and marginalized. And
by the way, let me say on this. Sorry, this is a hot issue.
And there's a lot of discussion yeah. about spending and what we're spending money on. Mm-hmm. But let's also be very, very clear what happened.
Well, I want you to answer
years.
The same question here.
I'm happy to. But let's also talk about what my colleague just said. What we've actually been spending all this money on is actually getting our country back on track. We just went through the single largest loss of life event in the modern era of our country. We lost over 1 million Americans. We spent money trying to keep people alive. We spent money trying to keep businesses afloat. We spent money to ensure that people were housed, people that needed support. And so, yes, we spent, there was significant spending, but it was spending to respond to this incredible pandemic.
So, and so I this have to idea, be respectful and say, and so this, you're saying like, government's the solution for this. I'm saying states like Iowa that opened back up, people were the solution.
We're in the business of government.
Oh,
so of course
help.
Government is
absolutely.
The solution.
So let's... with respect.
And as far as this unity amongst Republicans around the debt ceiling, the truth is there is no unity. We're not, the Democrats are united. We're not going to cut Social Security. We're not going to cut Medicare. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested to know how we're going to get to this resolution so that, because we know that this issue at the end of the day impacts working people the most.
So the discretionary spending you would cut is also in defense.
If it was up to me, we'd be raising taxes on billionaires and corporations. That's how we'd be getting more support. But I think Representative Lee is right. I think we have to be able to look at an institution like the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. I manage the police department. And it is okay to look at areas and make cuts. And we know how large it was beyond the Pentagon budget. The budget for defense, by the way, was larger than the president even asked for.
Republicans and Democrats both voted for that. Mm-hmm. Right. So let's be very clear here. If somebody is looking for an opportunity to go to college, they have the opportunity to serve in the military, and it will help pay for them to have the privilege of going to college. What I will not do is see members of the military who are on the front line defending our very opportunity to even mm-hmm. go to college have their paychecks cut or their opportunity to defend themselves cut because of lackluster equipment.
Let's humanize. There's a difference between sending our troops somewhere defenseless and then looking at our defense budget.
Right.
Which is the highest of the next, 20 countries combined?
Right.
We're not saying that we're sending.
Continually forced to defend the world.
With endless wars.
But Speaker McCarthy on this program last week said when it came to cutting discretionary spending, actually one of the places he would look to trim fat was the Defense Department.
Margaret, I don't sound like you're okay with that. So let's take, first of all, what he did say is take things off the table. We're going to protect Social Security. People have paid into that. They deserve to have that back. Republicans are committed to that. Let's take the Medicare that has gone out there to make sure that people have access to the health care they need to be successful off the table. When it comes to defense spending, what I just heard was cutting things across the board. If there's a review, everything should have the opportunity to be assessed.
So you're on board.
I think we should be looking across the board. And I would also say, here's where we have been successful in a state like Iowa that has the number one growth rate, is that we don't spend more than we take in.
How
about we grow the economy to begin with?
By taxing billionaires. We have not had a real budget
that doesn't grow the economy
in a very long time. And you have to go line by line, and you need these departments and agencies to justify their spending. Right. They have not had to do that in a very long time. We need a real budget process as part of this negotiation.
Sure, which takes time. We won't see the White House until March, and we got the debt ceiling date on
the calendar. Well, then I guess we'll be working,
which is why we're talking about it on Face the Nation. So we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you all for coming in. And I want to thank each and every one of you for joining our panel. Thanks for listening to this Face the Nation podcast bonus episode. As a reminder, you can watch Face the Nation every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern, 9:30 Central, or on Paramount Plus. If you want to listen, follow and listen to the Face the Nation showcast every Sunday, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary and it's not boring. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and maybe more importantly, on your life. I'm going to be your financial coach, someone who brings common sense and an insider's perspective on how to manage your money and your emotions. And I promise we are going to have a little bit of fun along the way. Have a question from retirement to career changes to college funding? Just send us an email at askjill@jillonmoney.com. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.
It was the biggest scandal in pop music. The stars of Milli Vanilli, the Grammy-winning multi-platinum R&B phenomenon, were exposed as frauds, but none of this was their idea. So whose idea was it? Enter German music producer Frank Farian. He saw the success of acts like Michael Jackson and Prince, and he wanted in, no matter the cost. So he devised the perfect pop heist. Two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? They couldn't sing. But Frank knew just how to fix that. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies and takes a never-before-heard look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when the truth came out, Rob and Fab were the only ones who got burned. Looking back now, it's hard not to wonder, why did everyone blame them and not the man pulling the strings? Follow Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.